You got to look down with Vic.
All right, this is Victor Cannicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is July 19, 2010. The time is approximately 3 p.m. Eastern Standard. I'm accompanied by Brad Bondi, Tom Krebs, John Armstrong, Tom Borgers, and Robert Hinckley of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and Mr. Edward Pinto. We're at the offices of the Commission for the interview of Mr. Pinto. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Pinto. Mr. Pinto, could I get your verbal assent for the record?
I consent.
All right. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. Brad, would you start?
Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I.
Yeah, Tom Krebs, K-R-E-B-S.
Cannicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I.
Jonathan Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G.
Tom Borgers, B-O-R-G-E-R-S.
Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-E-Y.
Ed Pinto, P-I-N-T-O.
Okay, in the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The Commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. The Commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the Commission was formed, sir, if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. At this time, I'll turn the question over to Mr. Bondi.
Appreciate it. Mr. Pinto, thanks again for coming in today. We did not expect such an elaborate presentation.
It was only half of what I have. I cut it back.
Oh, my God.
Initially, how this got sparked is we called you last week, just had a few questions for you, and you had indicated that you'd be in town today and would be happy to come in. So we appreciate you coming in today on short notice, and I guess it was just fortuitous that our call to you corresponded with your trip today. But as I said it before we went on record, we're looking at the changes in the housing market, particularly securitization and secondary market demand for mortgages, really from 2000 to 2008. How did demand change? Who was buying mortgages? What was Wall Street's role? What were the GSEs' roles? And I understand from you that there, we should also be thinking about FHA's role as well. But we're interested to know sort of the market dynamics that were occurring this past decade, and whatever research that you might have on that or data to enlighten us really on what was going on. I know you've met with our staff in the past and talked about affordable housing goals. I know you've talked about other issues. And our question is somewhat narrower in scope than what you've already covered. We are looking at the securitization and secondary market demand by the GSEs and Wall Street. But I know you have, looks like, some thoughts and information that go beyond that. We're welcome to hear that, but we do want to try to
I will focus
you on.
But I can get through the ancillary material quickly, but in my process of getting through this, this has been very important, so I think it would be useful potentially to you. The first 10 or 12 pages are a series of trends that I believe are significant and basically unprecedented. You've seen many of these before. I've added, as I've gotten comments from people, things like, well, the United States had a home ownership rate that went up substantially. In fact, our home ownership rate is sort of smack in the middle of the G7. There's some that are higher, some that are lower. There's different circumstances. But the fact of the matter is we ended up with a rapidly increasing home ownership rate, and we now end up at a spot that's roughly comparable to the G7, and we probably would have been there when we were at 64%, and 62%, we were sort of smack in the middle, more in the lower end. But again, we've gone through a process. Home values, real values, nominal values. What's unprecedented is the huge increase in the United States, and Those increases had been going on for a very long time, as I document in chart number three, but other countries had very large value increases also and did not end up with the downturn and the losses that we ended up with on mortgages. And I give some examples of foreclosure rates and delinquency rates in Canada and the United Kingdom. And I also give, you know, places that had much higher increases in home values and places that had lower increases in home values. What I think is, and I'm still developing this, my theory is, you know, what's unusual about the United States is we have a lot of room. Mm-hmm. As compared to other countries, most other countries, Belgium and France, and you know, they're well-developed urban, a lot of urban areas, and they didn't have a tremendous amount of new construction, I don't believe, as compared to the United States, and they had some supply and demand constraints as a result. We had very large price increases, yet we had a tremendous amount of additional home building that took place, and I've got a chart on that later.
And Ed, I understand that this packet is that you're going through is not finalized, but you'll give us a final
copy. Right, I'll give you a final copy, yes.
Okay.
Chart 3B, and I'm still working through. I haven't been able to tie the USA numbers they have here to the MBA, that dark line that goes around the middle. I think the rest of them are relatively representative. I remember Spain having a very high default rate in the early 90s because of some problems. I remember England having some problems also at that juncture. But the bottom line here is the United States had some high delinquency rates early in the decade of 1990s. It settled down and then started taking off. And of course, this chart ends in 07, and if you were to continue it, it would be off the chart. The point is, the United States has a very different end result than virtually any other country in the world. Community Reinvestment Act announced commitments. You've seen this chart before. Fannie, Freddie.
Ed, on the real briefly on the bottom of page 5, the Community Reinvestment Act announced commitments.
Uh-huh.
I take it this $4.5 trillion came from the NCRC's
yes.
Annual report from 07.
Yes.
Does that include the announced commitment that Bank of America
no.
made?
The $1.5 trillion with Countrywide?
Countrywide?
Does not. That
so,
takes
so,
it up to
so,
6.
So the number's actually $6 trillion.
Right. And it doesn't include what I also refer to as the CRA type commitment that Countrywide had for $1 trillion under HUD's. Best Practices Initiative.
I see. Thank you.
One of the things, and I'll get to it, that I think is very important is to benchmark where Fannie and Freddie started at in two respects in 1992. And we can figure out where they started at in terms of affordable housing by looking at Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae had a bit of a head start because of the $10 billion announced commitment that Jim Johnson announced in 1991. And I have a press release where he acknowledges that Fannie did more in 1993 relative to the goals that had been established for that reason. But Freddie Mac had no such jump start. They came into this cold. The act was passed in October of 92, the GSE Act. They came into it cold in 93 without any jump start. The goals were set purposefully for low and mod at 30% to make sure that both of them could cross that hurdle without any trouble. They thought that was basically the natural state, and in fact, and we'll see, Freddie Mac hit 30% on the nose. And that, so to me, that makes 30% basically the benchmark starting place of where these agencies were before things started going up over time.
In other words, 30% of the loans would be affordable. How to meet the
without doing housing. Anything.
Got it.
As a subset of that, I've also discovered, and again, it wasn't clear to me when I put triggers together. It was all there, but it never dawned on me. The focus of HUD throughout this time was almost entirely on the low and very low income component, what was known as special affordable. That's the number that really jumped. There was very little increase in, if you subtract that from the top line number, in what I would call the moderate number. And the moderate number is below 100% of median down to 80, and then the low is 80 to 60, and the very low is below 60 and below. And we'll get to those numbers in a minute. But the bottom line is we also know what Freddie's baseline was in 1993 because while there wasn't a goal in 1993, HUD did track attainment. And Freddie's attainment in 1993 was 7% for the special affordable. And so we now have a special affordable attainment of 7%, a low and mod attainment of 30%, meaning that 23% of it was moderate and 7% was low and very low, is how I interpret that. And if you flash forward to the end of this novel, you will see that I think they're at 57% and 27%. So you see that the top line number of low and mod is at 57%. You subtract the 27% from that, you get 30. So that means the moderate number went from 23 to 30 over this entire time period of 93 through 2008, whereas the low and very low went from 7 to 27, which is a huge increase. And we're going to that's important throughout this story, because that's what's driving the loosening of the underwriting year after year after year. And I can document that using LTV is the easiest thing to track, and the most but there are other characteristics also, but the easiest one to track is LTV.
Do you have performance data on special affordable versus LMI?
I have inferential performance data based on that special, the 10Q credit supplement that they published, which has the over 90, you know, the 95% LTV and above, and the FICO's below this and the FICO's below that. As you'll see, the over 90 LTV, which is effectively 95 and above, is used very much heavily for the low and very low, and I have data that shows that. So I can get to it inferentially. HUD did not publish any data showing income groups relative to FICO scores. I think that's one of the things you want to get from Fannie and Freddie, is exactly what was the performance of their loans that met the various income categories, the special affordable categories, and the low and moderate categories net of the special affordable. And then there was that third category, which is the I can never remember the name of it. We'll get to it. But there's a third category, the geographic-based category. And I believe, based on all the data, and I referred to it at the end here, I believe that the performance of the special affordable group was very poor, because it tended to be high LTVs, extraordinarily high LTVs, and it tended to be lower FICOs, higher debt ratios, not necessarily all in the same loan, but it tended to be those types of characteristics.
Ed, if maybe as we're going, and also after we leave, if you could keep a running list, or someone keep a running list of the documents that you believe are not in the public domain, but are documents that you think are important to understanding.
Well, the first one, and I don't know who, if somebody can keep the list. The first one, the first one is the actual performance of, and you know I've, you know, talked about this for CRA, the actual performance of Fannie and Freddie's loans by characteristic, LTV, et cetera, debt ratios, and credit score, and how that relates to the three income goals groupings of low and mod, special affordable, and the only way to really, I think, make sense of it is to start from the bottom. You've got the special affordable, which is again the 80 and below roughly, and then say, okay, now that you've given me the special affordable, subtract those out and then give me what's left.
So phrase that in terms of a question, so that we get that, we understand what you're getting at here. So the, you know, performance data for each of the three categories over time, currently, what?
Over time isn't going to tell you a whole lot, because what was going on, although relatively speaking, the delinquency rates were low. The relative delinquency rates, the relationship between the delinquency rates, probably still held in that the special affordable were performing substantially worse, albeit at a relatively low delinquency level, substantially worse than the others. So if you had them over time, that would be good.
You would expect that, though, right?
You would expect that, but the point is, and we're going to get to this. I actually have a document, and I brought the original, and you can make a copy of it. I have a random sample. Fannie Mae had a quality control process that involved taking a random sample of its purchases every year, during the course of a year. And I have a printout from January 1992, which just happens to predate exactly when this stuff started, because the law is passed in 92, October. The $10 billion commitment is announced in 91. Very little of it's done by 1992, and this is dated January 92. And it shows the characteristics of Fannie Mae's portfolio based on this random sample using 30 or 40 different loan characteristics, LTV, debt ratios, credit, FICOs weren't in use, but credit indicators, first-time home buyers, et cetera, a whole host of things. And what it allows one to do is determine what conventional lending looked like in 1991 before the changes wrought by the 92 Act. And so you can benchmark where they were in terms of this income category that I've mentioned, you can also benchmark in terms of what the loans looked like. And as I said, I brought that with me, and you can make a copy of that.
But going back to the request.
Yeah.
Performance data over time from the three categories, and what are the three categories?
Three categories are special affordable, I would break down the special affordable had two components. It had the less than 60%, and as you know, these things got very complicated, and it had the 60 to 80% group, and then you had the, what was the other one called?
And by 60 to 80%, you mean
median
LTV?
No, of median. It was less than 60% of median income, 60 to 80% of median. And then the moderate group was 80 to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the underserved. That was the last one. And again, there was overlap between special affordable and the underserved. And so I have focused on the special affordable and the moderate component of the low and mod, because while there's still probably a little bit of overlap, there's not as much because it was all income defined.
Mr. Pinto, you said those were special affordable, which you broke to less than 60.
Of median.
Of median and 60 to 80.
Of median.
And then moderate was 80 to 100%.
Right. Right.
And what was the third?
Underserved.
Underserved.
And the underserved definition is very complicated, and it overlaps with these income groups. It basically was a race-based definition. That was based on census tracts. And so I have focused on the special affordable and the balance of the affordable housing goals, which is the moderate portion that's left after you subtract out the special affordable.
So, Ed, so on that last group, the underserved, would they also have the medium income on that too?
It had to do, and again, it's a complicated definition. My recollection, just going from memory, is it was census tracts that had 30% underserved, which was defined in the regulations, and then had some income component. You're going to have to go look it up. It was a very complex definition that was, again, based on trying to get at the race of the areas that Fannie and Freddie were supposed to lend in, racial makeup of the areas.
Special affordable, moderate, underserved.
Right.
Okay.
Price-to-rent ratio, you've seen the ratio of home real price index to real cost building index. You've seen, I've got a series of three articles, not a series, but I've got three articles coming out in the next 3 months or so on this whole issue of the shortcomings of the appraisal process the inability of the appraisal process to get at these issues. And that's what I was just working on, actually, before I came over here.
All these three charts more or less show the same thing, right?
No.
Well, I mean, they show house prices.
They show house prices going up, but they show that they're going up in the fundamental relative to the fundamentals. You could have house prices going up and keeping with the fundamentals.
Yeah, these are different.
These are saying they're going up, but the fundamentals are not supporting those house prices.
Got
it. That's different.
Got it.
And you could have inflation you know, pushing house cost indexes up, but not necessarily pushing rents up because of, so again, I think they're showing different things, but they're all related, but they are showing different things. On page chart 7, median house price to median income is again showing that the fundamentals are getting outstripped by the house price increases. Gross equity extraction is a very important piece, and it ties to a key element here, which is the 1986 Tax Act, had all kinds of impacts, and I'll discuss it briefly, but it had all kinds of impacts on what happened, both on the subprime market. There's an entire history on how the 1986 Tax Act really gave birth to the subprime market, and to the home equity business, home equity lending, and to cash out refis. And I'll talk about that.
This is an amazing chart here, this one.
The investor?
Yeah.
It's particularly amazing because, again, I have a benchmark of where Fannie and Freddie were in 1992, and they were almost out of the investor lending market. And I take credit for that personally because I got Fannie out of that in 1985. When I got there in 1984, mm-hmm. and they were doing too many investor loans because they were very risky. And I pushed them out of it, and then with the rewrite of their underwriting, Fannie's underwriting in 85, it pushed them out further. And so while the market was at somewhere between 5 and 6%, Fannie and Freddie were down at 1 or 2. Mm-hmm. And again, that was the benchmark. But, of course, the goals found these loans to be goals rich because they were 1 to 4 unit rentals. And so even if they were done as a no-income, no-asset, mm-hmm. they still counted. And I have evidence to show that.
So even if they were an Alt-A...
That's one of the reasons why Fannie and Freddie went after Alt-A. And you'll see, after the fact, if you look at what FHFA has done in their latest, as of 3 months ago, they came out with their new goals, they have fixed five things. Mm-hmm. One of the things they fixed is they no longer require, they only focus on purchase owner-occupied primary residences. They talk about the fact that what happened with the small rentals, it ended up being a problem, and this is the problem. It promoted Fannie and Freddie investing in investor loans. They also talk about the fact that because it applied to both refi and purchase, that was a problem, and they now only apply to purchase mortgages, home purchase mortgages, not to refis, because that had a distorting impact. They also talk about how they no longer expect that the goals are going to apply, you know, years into the future. Mm-hmm. They have a double standard, one of which is market-based. I mean, they have all these changes they've made that recognize the shortcomings of the goals process.
Do you have that document?
It's on FHFA's web. I think it was in March of this year when they came out with the new goals.
Tom Borgers, if you can track that down, that'd be great.
Okay. But this is, you can just see, you know, how this just grows and grows and grows. And this is based on the Federal Reserve data.
So can I ask you a quick question about, as Brett was getting at here, so this was the Alt-A.
This is largely driven by Alt-A.
And that was part of the CRA, too, because it could have been...
Affordable housing.
Affordable housing. Because it could have been in the underserved community.
It could have been underserved. It could have been. It was particularly, and I think I have it in here, special affordable. The rentals, these rentals. When you, because these were, Fannie and Freddie didn't know what these units rented for, or who was living in them, or what their income was. The assumptions under the goals was that was based on the census tract it was in. So if it was in a census tract that met certain criteria, it was presumed to be either a low or very low income.
Okay,
and that's how they got credit.
This is a very important thing that it never hit me as a mortgage banker. So what you're saying is that it was not driven by the investor. It was actually driven by the units.
The units, yeah.
That is off the charts.
That's why they didn't need to know the income of the investor.
Sure.
It was irrelevant. All they needed to know was that it was rental.
Right.
Once they knew, and a rental, it could have been a one-unit rental. It could have been a two-unit building that either had one or two units rental. It could have been a three-unit building with one, two, or three units, or one or three units. You know, excuse me. You could have two, one. Let's see. You could have two or three units rental. Or you could have all, yeah, you could have all three. You could have one that would be owner-occupied, but not necessarily. Or it could be a four-unit that, again, had at least three rental units, or it could have had four if the it was not owner-occupied entirely. And so you never, if for the non-owner-occupied units, you need to know nothing about the, nothing related to the borrower was relevant. It was only the where the units were located.
This is because this unit is located in an area that historically is underrepresented, at least with respect to minorities.
Or income. It was in a lower income.
Income was either 16% or whatever.
So it's that either or LMI or LMICT.
Yeah. Okay.
This is, I've never heard this before. This is great.
So what documents do you have that shows that, that no income, no assets counted for that?
Okay, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay. New home sales, as I mentioned, I think this is a distinguishing, I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to look at it, you know, compared to some other countries, but clearly our new home sales took off. Normally they were in cycles that ran 4 or 5 years, and all of a sudden we had the long cycle that went on forever, seemingly, and home sales, new home sales, went from a low of 400,000 to a high of 1.4 million, which was unprecedented. And all of this resulted, number 12, chart 11, in a stimulation of the market that dampened delinquencies. And normally what happens, and you see it in this red here, when the red gets very low, that's when there are almost no property, no markets of the top 100 MSAs that are declining in value. And those periods usually last for just a short period of time, and then something happens, some economic event, usually regional, kicks in and pushes these up.
Can you explain that? I don't understand chart 11.
Chart 11 is showing the distribution for the top 100 MSAs tracked for a period of 25 years.
MSA.
Metropolitan Statistical Area.
Okay.
And so it's the 100 largest metropolitan statistical areas, mm-hmm. and it's tracking them on a four-quarter rollover compared to the previous
By population growth.
No, this is house price.
Okay.
What's going on with house prices? Growth rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so, are the growth rates negative, which is red? Are they 0 to 5%, which is the light blue? Are they 5 to 10%, which is the dark blue? Are they the purple or are they the black?
Mm-hmm.
And normally, you've got activity going on of the red almost all the time, except this little time period during a boom. You know, we know there was a boom in the late 70s, and it drops to zero. And we know there was a boom in the late 80s. It didn't quite drop to zero, but it, you know, had a relative to some other times. It was a low spot. And then we have this time period that starts in 98. You got to be careful. As you read this chart, you'll see that the 1976 quarter three is well over to the left, and so the first column actually is the quarter that goes with it is to the left, and then you see there's a time period roughly starting in late 97 that continues until 06, where there are almost no MSAs out of the 100 that have declining house prices, and that is sending a signal to the market that everything is fine and that delinquencies get dampened by that because house prices are going up and everything is fine and just continue going. And that, I think, explains in some measure why, you know, lenders were willing and Fannie and Freddie to some extent perhaps willing to loosen even further because they're looking at this and going, oh boy, things are actually in pretty good shape. This is actually a Fannie chart that
Pinto, you've done it to me again.
What?
Damn it. The first time I read your paper, I says, damn, here's the answer. How can it get any better than this? This is right here. You put it right down where the goats can eat it. And
well,
damn it, you come back now and do it again. I can't believe it.
Well, okay. Now we get into what actually happened. And chart 12 is, I think, the beginning of sort of explaining what happened and why FHA is important. Because you see, and what got me thinking about this was the hearings that you had, particularly John, I never get his name, Ganopoulos, is that the
name? Uh-huh, right.
And some of the others. If you go back to the hearings.
The guy from Yale.
The guy from Yale.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to your hearings, you'll see a common thread, not everybody, but there's a common thread talking about leverage.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talking about leverage. And there was a double leveraging going on. There was a leveraging of homeowners or home buyers and homeowners, and there was a leveraging of the financial institutions. And the government's policies are involved with both. Let's focus on the home buyer leverage or the homeowner leverage, and let's focus on the most obvious example of that, which is down payment. And if you look, the leader, the clear leader of down payment reduction is FHA. This shows FHA compared to Fannie. I don't have equivalent for subprime, but I have anecdotal information about subprime that shows that, I mean, in fact, subprime used to be known as hard money lending, was sort of a misnomer, but people use that term. Why? Because it required a down payment. And by the way, subprime was not used very much on purchase transactions. So again, this is focusing, in the case of Fannie, I could get it purchase transactions. FHA is primarily purchase transactions. And while this includes both purchase and refi, you can see what the trends are. And what it shows is back in 1981, down payments, ultra low down payments, 3% or less, were almost zero. And Fannie and Freddie were zero. There wasn't a conventional market in down payments of 3% or less. Those didn't start until 1994. Because you needed mortgage insurance, and that's when the mortgage insurance became available, was in 1994. So you see the numbers starting to go up. Fortunately, HUD reported these numbers in the PDR policy and whatever DR, development research, whatever that stands for, reports very voluminously on the number of purchase transactions that had down payments of less than 3% or less. They even report on it based on income, you know, on those categories, the low and very low and the moderate. And it's just for purchase, and you can also get at the refi. But you see that FHA was leading the market here, and Fannie and Freddie didn't get into the market until 1994, grew fairly slowly, and then after the changes to their goals in 2000, which were pre-announced in 99 to be applicable for 2000, turns out they don't become applicable 2001, but Fannie and Freddie end up doing it in advance because they thought they were going to be applicable 2000. And you see that these percentages start going up asymptotically after 2000. And they eventually, Fannie gets to close to 40%. I have some other information right below this that the NAR, National Association of Realtors, does a survey every year. I'm not sure how many people they surveyed, et cetera, but they published what home buyers were putting in the way of down payment. And the one that really caught my attention was the one from 2006. And what it said was that nearly half, it turns out I think it's 46%, of all first-time home buyers put nothing down in 2006. Mm. And so you can see how this chart is going up and eventually gets to a point where the NAR is reporting that. And that the average the median down payment of first-time home buyers is 2%. And so you can see that about three-quarters of all first-time home buyers put a down payment of 3% or less, round numbers just statistically. And about 40% of all home buyers are first-time home buyers. So roughly three-quarters of 40% is about 30%. And then they say that 20% of the repeat buyers, which are the other 60% of the market, put down zero down, which is about 12%. So based on the NAR number, you get to about 42%, which is in the ballpark of what I get here at 39%. It's close. One of the things that's hard to get at is with precision is the CLTVs, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But this is basically further evidence that the percentages that Fannie and Freddie had, Freddie's are similar, are basically what's similar to what the NAR is reporting.
And two very specific questions. One, from your sources on this, I notice you have the percentages from 94 to 96 are estimated, and then you say the CLTV from 04 or 07 are based on Fannie's disclosures in 07. What about from 96 to 2004, the data on Fannie, in particular, say, from looks like 95 or so, 96 to 2004, where is that data coming from Fannie's?
Oh, that's coming from the PDR, the HUD PDR.
Okay.
So it says actuarial report is where FHA is coming from, and HUD, the NHUD is the HUD PDR report. You've got those reports, right?
I'll show you what they look like as I brought them here.
Suspect we do it, but here's that.
Okay. It's these profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the back, there's a chart that allows you to get at all this stuff. You have to do some you know, calculations, but you can get at all that stuff.
Is there any data on this with respect to Fannie, at least in recent times from 97 to 2007, that you're having to estimate?
Yes. And so the second question would be, Fannie and Freddie, what are your purchase transactions? I think it's very important to focus on purchase transactions, not refi, for two reasons. One is it's purchase transactions that's driving largely what's going on. The refi has a second effect, which is the extraction of equity. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, and FHFA documents this, appraisals on refis are notoriously inaccurate. Cash-out refis are notoriously inaccurate because they basically work backwards into what the borrower needs. And FHFA, OFIA, old OFIO, actually found that out and published two price trends, one all loans and one purchase only, because they started noticing that the all loan numbers were doing odd things relative to the purchase numbers. And if you then take their data and back out the purchases from the all loans and then back out what's left as refi, and you back out the rate and term refis from that, you see that the LTVs on cash out refis seem to overestimate by about 6 to 7%. So when you say you have a 90% cash out refi, it's really 95, 6, or 7%, and so it doesn't show up in these. On the other hand, a purchase transaction you can actually isolate to, and so the data that would be useful to have is the CLTV, combined loan to value data, with down payments of less than of five. Of, let's see, how do they describe it? Let's see. Yeah, it's. I would say you want the, they're called 80-15-5, meaning an 80% first, a 15% second, a 5% equity, or an 80-20-0. They don't usually say zero, which means 80% first, 20% second. I'm not aware, although that's not to say it didn't exist, I'm not aware of an 80-17-3. That was a creature of the MI structure, in the premium structure. There's no logical reason why you'd necessarily have one of those.
You have this down as the second question.
This is the second question, is to ask Fannie and Freddie for home purchase, going back as far as they can go back, but you know, or as far as you want to go back. Again, the only data I was able to find in the case of both Fannie and Freddie was in 2007. Both of them happened to have a reference in their 10-Ks or 10-Qs to the fact that while in Fannie's case, 9.9% of its loans had a total loans had a down payment or an LTV greater than, I want to say greater than 95%, because that ties to that provision in the. In their disclosure, that special the credit supplement, that when they take into account combined loan to value, the number goes from 9.9 to 15, which means that for every 10 roughly PMI loans that they know they have with very low down payments, there's another 5 that have a CLTV with a similarly low down payment.
So Ed, is it just to simplify things, is the following you're getting at, what percentage of your portfolio from whatever date to whatever date had a 95% or greater combined LTV for purchase mortgages? Is that
I think it's greater than 95.
Greater than 95?
Greater than, which effectively means 97.
Okay.
Greater than
95. Greater than
95. For home purchase and by year by year. And then you can do two things. And later on, I have a chart here that actually breaks out the CLTV from my estimate.
Mm-hmm.
You can add the additional numbers for the years I didn't try to estimate, and then you could check my estimates for the years I did estimate. What I just did was I said, okay, if you ended up at the end of 07 with 50% extra, those didn't all come in like that. You got them over a period of 4 years, and I just spread them out over the 4 years relative to the PMI rate that I knew from the PDR report, and so I just incrementally increased those, and we'll get to that.
I see.
And I could have done the same thing for Freddie, because Freddie published the same thing, coincidentally. But they only publish it like once each.
Ed, if we were to take this to 90%, it would be... Do you have any idea what the percentage would be?
Yes, actually I do. Gemico, Genworth now, actually tracked this, and I have an article. It's not referred to in here. But they actually tracked the over 80 percentage for LTV, actual numbers per year, that were FHA, were PMI, and CLTV, and how those... the problem is, the growth that we're... And this gets back to John's testimony. At the margin, there was so much more bang that the 3% zero down had compared to the 10% down, that you need to focus on the threes and the zeros, and that's what I've done here.
Well,
because
I
of the leverage you got.
I was just looking at the alt A, which is a huge part of the market, is that some of it was 5% down, some of it was 10% down.
LTV or CLTV?
It could have been CLTV. Yeah.
Well, it was let's jump to a third category. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of this. You know that Fannie and Freddie were big purchasers of the PMBS, mm-hmm. Subprime and Alt-A. Fannie and Freddie, and again, this is the question you want to frame, were huge purchasers of whole loan Alt-A from Wall Street and from Countrywide and other originators, but Wall Street in particular. And unlike subprime, and this is, you know, I use the term self-denominated subprime, self-denominated alt A. Mm-hmm. While Fannie and Freddie did not purchase self-denominated subprime whole loans, with the exception of a small amount, $8 billion or something, in Fannie's case, and a billion or two in Freddie's case, they purchased hundreds of millions of dollars of whole loan alt A that were called alt A. And they purchased them, by and large, in bulk transactions. The important word is bulk transactions. Have you looked at the bulk transactions at all? Okay. And they were buying them directly from Wall Street and others, the originators. And those loans had NINA loans, and they had no income, no assets. They had 80-20s. They had 20%, I don't know, my guess is investors.
Option arms?
Excuse me?
Option arms? Also.
No. They, by and large, did not have option arms, okay. Although Fannie and Freddie did buy some, but I don't believe they bought them as... most of them were hybrids. They were mostly 5- and 7-year hybrids, maybe some threes, but mostly 5, 7, and 10s, mostly 5 and 7s. So some threes, some 10s, but mostly 5s and 7s. Some of them were fixed rate, a few, you know, that changed over time. But this started, I don't know exactly when it started, but it was going pretty actively in 03, and is the reason why Fannie and Freddie, and again, I have a chart in here, are really the dominant force in Alt-A, because... when you look at the inside mortgage finance numbers, which really report what got put into securities, PMBS, inside mortgage finance ignores, it just doesn't even track what Fannie and Freddie are buying before they ever get into the PMBS. And that's these bulk transactions that are whole loans. They're not securitized yet.
So this is the third question, and how are we framing this as a question? We're asking for Alt A from Fannie.
And I would ask for subprime too.
Subprime.
But I don't believe they bought much in subprime, but it won't hurt to ask. Mm-hmm. But I know they bought a lot of Alt A. So bulk purchases of Alt A and subprime whole loans. They bought them from Wall Street, they bought them from originators, Countrywide, et cetera. I don't know that you need to get into that level, do you? Who you bought them from, what the transaction size, you know, characteristics. these were purchased as bulk transactions. They looked at each transaction. They looked at the characteristics of each transaction. And so, again, it's not, this was not a flow business. They weren't buying them one at a time or whatever. Mm-hmm. These loans are already originated. They were buying them in bulk.
And from when?
And I would say from the beginning of when you started buying bulk, but I believe that's probably in the early 2000s. I don't know the exact date, but I'm guessing, you know, maybe 2000, 2001. It's in the time period you're ultimately interested in. Certainly by, you know, the 2003, 2004, it's moving. And that's how Fannie and Freddie got these huge amounts, relatively speaking, of those Alt-A that show up on that special, you know, key attribute page of Fannie's supplemental credit thing.
Ed, when they purchased these mortgages in bulk, if they were purchasing Alt-A, would they have known ahead of time whether these mortgages counted toward their goals, and did they track that in terms of going into the purchase? In other words, if Fannie was purchasing a bulk group of Alt-A mortgages, would their decision to purchase that be based or contemplated ahead of time on their goals and needs?
I believe the answer to that is yes. I don't have any evidence of that. But, again, they would have gotten a tape that would have had, I believe, enough information. These goals, you knew, it got down. They had whole departments, as you know. And they knew what census tracts, they knew what income groups, they knew, you know, on the small rentals, they knew what the requirements were. And they could run these tapes, presumably through this grid or a sieve, and figure out what kind of yield they would get. Now, how they did that, what they precisely did, I'm not exactly sure, but certainly it was doable, and I assume they did that, again, based on some of the comments that we're going to get into a little bit later. But this is very important because as far as the Alt-A is concerned, and remember, Fannie's Alt-A and Freddie's Alt-A loans were all conforming. Alt-A loans that they didn't buy had an average dollar amount of $300,000. Fannie and Freddie's average Alt-A was $170,000. So that's how they ended up with a huge percentage of the Alt-A. Now, some people say, yes, but they didn't get the worst of the Alt-A. Well, that's perfectly explainable because they got first dibs. They got to pick what they wanted. And then what was left, these loans were already made. It's not like they weren't, you know, but Fannie and Freddie were a demand for them. I mean, people knew what they would buy because these transactions were rolling through, you know, all the time. And so they knew that Fannie and Freddie had certain criteria of what they would buy in the way of Alt-A, and Fannie and Freddie would pick and choose what they wanted. They'd pick and choose some on the, I presume, some on the basis of the affordable housing requirements.
Ed, in the interest of time, I'm looking at my watch. We have about at least Tom Borgers and I have a hard stop at 5:30,
okay.
Or at least a little bit before, probably about 5:15.
Okay.
We've got roughly an hour left. Can we hop over to like 99?
Yeah, let me just see what else is not. Okay.
We can come back and talk about the.
Okay, let me just say in 1991, is the industry has got three components. It's got a prime market, and I describe the results of this random sample. So, for example, loan to values, only zero loans have an LTV of greater than 95%. It doesn't exist in 1991. Very few have LTVs of 5.5%. 1% of cash out refis have an LTV above 80. You go down the list. FHA, on the other hand, has a 12% market share at that point, and 79% of their loans have an LTV greater than 90. And 17% of an LTV greater than or equal to 97%. So you can see FHA is really the leader. Self-denominated subprime, 12% are for home purchases, 60% are for refinance. Average loan to values in 1995, which was the earliest data I could find, was 76%. Again, they tended to have fairly sizable down payments. Fannie's down payment average was 73%, and FHA's was 95%. And so you can see FHA was the leader.
Can I maybe suggest that we skip to around page 40?
Yep. Let me just see. Let me just go over one quote on page 20. there's that a series of hearings that are held in 1991. At one hearing, a community group, there are a number of community group witnesses, community advocacy witnesses, and at one hearing before the Senate Banking Committee, they testify. This is out of his article. Lenders will respond to the most conservative standards unless Fannie and Freddie are aggressive and convincing in their efforts to expand historically narrow underwriting, which they haven't done yet, and unless they're forced to, in effect. And the intent is very clear that Fannie and Freddie have to change their underwriting, and if Fannie and Freddie change their underwriting, then banks will change theirs. Moving along. Page 25 shows that incremental for the CLTV broken out. It's the same chart as before, but with the incremental broken out. The chart on page 18 shows how the GSEs became more and more dependent. Chart 18, page 26.
Okay.
Became more and more dependent on the LTVs above 95 to fulfill the low and very low. And this gets at the time period you're interested in because it picks up in 99. And you can see it goes from what this is showing is compared to the loans that are made to moderate income borrowers, if they made 100 to moderate income borrowers, 45 would be made to low and very low in 1999. By 2005, for every 100 they're making to low income, moderate income borrowers, they're making 88 to low and very low.
And so, let me pause right there real quick on chart 18. Because I see HUD Office of Policy and Development and Research and then Ann Ed Pinto. What from this chart is extrapolated from you and what is from HUD?
It's all from HUD. If you go to the HUD Office of Policy Development and Research, you won't find this chart. I had to assemble the chart from the data.
I see. So all the data is publicly available.
Yeah.
Understood.
Chart 19 presents the same data slightly differently. Okay. Page 30 talks about Countrywide's role, some more about subprime, et cetera. The affordable housing goals are laid out for all the years, starting with 96 on chart 20. Again, getting to chart 21 gets at your time period. HUD eventually in 2000 says, oh, by the way, in the future, trying to figure out what's a prime loan and a subprime loan is going to get increasingly more difficult because we're pushing Fannie and Freddie to do more subprime loans. But once they buy them, they don't call them subprime, and therefore it's going to get very difficult to figure out what's going on in the future. They actually say that in 2000 in their rulemaking. And which is why I create the impaired definition that I use, which says it's either self-denominated subprime or it's below 660 FICO. If you apply that definition to the three categories that I could track, which are the self-denominated subprime out of Inside Mortgage Finance, the FHA out of FHA's actuarial study based on a sample, and Fannie and Freddie's subprime number, FICO numbers that they report, and their private subprime private MBS acquisitions, you see that Fannie and Freddie's share among those three groups rises continuously from 97 through 2004. The reason it goes up in 2004 is because they're buying a lot of the tranches. FHA's stays pretty strong and actually grows a bit through 2001, but then starts falling after that, in effect because Fannie and Freddie are actually crowding them, and the same thing's happening with LTV. Interestingly, the subprime market is actually shrinking as in terms of market share through defined the way I've defined it, through 2003, grows a little bit in 2004, and then grows a lot in 2005, 2006, and 2005 and 2006. And I think I'm off by 1 year.
So the yellow is the private sector?
Private sector.
And the blue is Fannie and Freddie?
Yep.
And okay.
I misspoke when I said 2003. It increases through 2003 for Fannie, Freddie, and FHA. Fannie and Freddie increased through 2004. The private sector pushes back mostly by reducing FHA in 2004, and then in 2005 it pushes back quite a bit more, and FHA gets marginalized, and then Fannie and Freddie are being affected. Again, remember, in the blue are the Fannie and Freddie's purchases of subprime, which I've calculated at something over 30% of all of those subprime tranches that ever get issued. So now we get to just about where you said, 1999. Uh-huh. HUD at that point is very critical to what goes on next, and FHA being part of HUD. HUD in 1999 is wearing four hats. Hat number one is it's the promulgator of the National Homeownership Strategy, which in 1995 called for a continued reduction in down payments, notwithstanding all the progress that had been made, which it talks about what the percentages are since 1993. It acknowledges that it was due to the 92 Act and CRA, that flexible lending needs to expand further, and it acknowledges that flexible lending has expanded substantially since the 92 Act. But it says a lot more has to be done. That's hat number one. Hat number two is it is the promulgator of the rules for Fannie and Freddie. Mm-hmm. And number three is it is the its initiative, the best practices initiative, of which its primary participant is Countrywide, is hat number three. And hat number four
back up there, I don't understand.
It announced in 1994, in lieu of going to Congress and getting CRA expanded to mortgage bankers, it had an agreement with the mortgage banking industry that it would institute something called the Best Practices Initiative within HUD. And the first bank, national mortgage banker to sign up was Countrywide. And Countrywide issued a commitment against that and eventually issued $1 trillion.
Was this when Countrywide was an OCC bank then?
No, this is a mortgage. They're a mortgage banker. This is before they buy a bank.
Okay.
This is while they're a mortgage banker. They buy a bank in, I think, 2000, roundabout. Mm-hmm. But their business is still primarily mortgage banking, and they have a little banking operation. That banking operation becomes more and more significant to their operations later. But at this juncture, from 1994 through the early part of 2000, it either doesn't exist, it doesn't own a bank, or it's de minimis.
Okay, so they put rules in place.
They put a program, an initiative, they called it an initiative. Mm-hmm. And they actually had, and I've got an example in here, they had mortgage bankers sign an agreement, a best practices agreement that called for lower down payments, lowering down payments, more flexible underwriting, the same kinds of things that CRA and Fannie and Freddie's affordable housing goals were going.
And Countrywide signed up for that.
Countrywide was the first one to sign up as a national lender and was first and foremost in that program. And eventually,
what was the goal there? Was it to get non-regulated entities writing the loans?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. It was to avoid. They threatened the administration in 1994. Said we'll go to Congress and get CRA expanded. We'll ask Congress to expand CRA unless you agree to this, and there was a voluntary agreement among what that, and again, if you go back to the 1995 strategy, the homeownership strategy, because they had CRA, because they had Fannie and Freddie, because they had this initiative, they now had all of the mortgage banking industry, the whole mortgage finance industry, they could bring them together under the National Homeownership Strategy in 1995. Had all the players there in place.
One quick question here. This is key on the. So they didn't go to the banking industry because the banking industry would have been regulated,
right?
With the guidance under subprime and so on. So they went to the non-banking so they could avoid the regulation.
I wouldn't say it that way. They went to the mortgage banking industry, which wasn't covered directly by CRA, and they asked them to participate in the loosening of underwriting standards in order to promote low and moderate income housing.
No, just real quick. The reason why they didn't go to the banking is because the bankers had to adhere to the subprime guidance of FDIC, of the Federal Reserve back in 1999 and such.
Well, this predates 1999.
Oh, yeah, but this is key for us to understand that they didn't go to the banks. They went to the non-banks because the non-banks, you know, could do whatever they really want.
Again, I don't draw that conclusion. But, okay. The way it was described at the time, which I believe is true, was we want CRA only applies to depository institutions. More and more of the business is outside of CRA because more and more is either done by mortgage bankers like Countrywide, which was not regulated as a depository institution because it wasn't one at that point, or are outside of the banks themselves. And therefore, we will go to Congress to get, in 1994, to get CRA expanded beyond depository institutions. The Mortgage Banking Association, Mortgage Bankers Association, said, and they said, in lieu of us doing that, if you agree voluntarily to this program, this initiative, we will back off and not do that. The Mortgage Bankers Association said, we will do that. And then they came up with a model agreement, which I have reference to one that I found, that HUD, and HUD eventually entered into 150 of these agreements, and with various entities.
Are those public?
I found one public, which I believe is representative. It's just the only one I found.
Which one did you find?
I forget the name. It's in here somewhere. I forget the name of the
thing. Can you send that to us?
What is it called? The best practices.
And Ed, I'm not familiar with this best practices history here.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any background and reading material on this,
I think it's in the original. It's in the. Oh, I know where it is. It's in the either Exhibit 2 or Exhibit 3 of my exhibits that I provided, separate from Triggers. It's documented in there quite voluminously. I'll find out where it is and tell you documentation. As I said, I found an actual example of what, and it's the usual round of the usual suspects. You need to make smaller down payments. You need to provide for smaller down payments. You need to loosen your lending, and you agree to do that so that you will end up with more low and moderate income people getting housing.
Are the list of banks that signed up for that public?
No, you'd have to get that. I only know of two, Countrywide, because it was very public about it, and then this one that I happened to stumble on, which actually was a subprime lender out of Texas.
So, in other words, what we could ask for is from HUD the list of banks that signed up and copies of those agreements.
And I would try to find out about that program because while it was a large program, they talked about 150 mortgage bankers participating. HUD never really issued any kind of report that said here's what's happened under it. I believe there's a connection between what HUD was doing and pushing lenders, these mortgage bankers, and what ultimately happened with subprime.
But these are not really bankers. These were mortgage.
They were mortgage bankers.
Which is outside the regulatory environment.
Ed, let me play devil's advocate. If these people signed the agreement and they said, well, we just can't do that or we just are concerned about it, was there any enforcement mechanism for these agreements?
They certainly threatened enforcement, and they were doing that on the bank side with the CRA lending side. These were voluntary agreements. What they did in the way of enforcement, again, I would ask FHA, I would ask HUD what they did. I don't know. All I know is the first and foremost participant, Countrywide, took this program and worked it against Fannie, Freddie, HUD, and ultimately the subprime market, and became the 10,000-pound gorilla.
But more importantly, Ed, doesn't this program signify to the mortgage bankers that this type of lending is not only permissible now,
but encouraged? Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think the lesson, again, with HUD wearing these four hats, the message is very clear. In each one of these hats, HUD is saying or doing, loosen the underwriting standards, reduce down payments. And so they are pushing Fannie and Freddie to do that directly through the goals. They have it as part of their strategy, national housing strategy, in terms of implementation strategies. And they have it as part of this initiative, best practices.
The fourth hat.
And the fourth hat is FHA. They're doing it through FHA. Because FHA, as evidenced by that little quiz at the beginning, in 1999 and probably before, a couple of years before, is the leader in low down payment lending. They are the leader, I believe, or close to it, in debt ratios. They may, certainly in the purchase transaction side, they're the leader. The subprime market probably was about par with them on debt ratios on refis. And they are clearly the leader on FICO scores, although they didn't track FICO scores particularly. That's why they said we don't even... there's no minimum FICO score because they didn't look at FICO scores.
What was the implicit sanction to be applied in connection with a breach of the best practices agreement?
It was all done under fair housing, and so if the sanction wouldn't necessarily be for the breach of the agreement, is if they went in and started looking at your turndown rates and said, well, your turndown rates are higher for this or that, then they could bring a action against you for breach of fair housing. And that's my understanding of how what HUD did, is they would look at turndown rates. And in fact, I believe, and I forget who the lender was, it might be Countrywide. I think you've seen this Fannie Mae Foundation's review of Countrywide that dates, I think, 2000 or something. Have you seen that? But there's a statement in there where they talk about how Countrywide's turndown rates based on minority status is very low. It's tracked by Countrywide, and B, it's very low relative to other lenders, and that's positive for Countrywide. I think it was 1.3 to 1, and most lenders were 2 to 1. But it's talked about in that document that Fannie...
Tell me, would you agree with the following statement, though, is mortgage originators had two concerns when they were originating mortgages. One, to find a place to sell those mortgages because they had an originate-to-distribute model, so mm-hmm. they needed to find buyers in mm-hmm. the secondary market. And two, they needed to make sure that what they were doing was not considered predatory lending.
Right.
What HUD did is basically, in essence, say what you're doing there with low down payments and the type of mortgages here is not predatory lending and, in fact, is encouraged.
It's a national policy.
And then through Fannie and Freddie gave them a place to actually sell those mortgages as well.
Yes, and you know, as you know, Fannie and Freddie were considered the standard setters, which had a dual role. One is they'd always been a standard setter going back decades. And so when Fannie and Freddie announced they were going to buy 3% down loans, that was a signal to the broader marketplace that those types of loans were now blessed or okay. When Fannie and Freddie announced they were going to do zero down loans in 2000, that was a signal to the marketplace. When Fannie and Freddie, and I have some data, when they announced they were going to do debt ratios, not of 28-36, not of 33-38, but of something 42, that was a signal to the marketplace that those types of ratios were acceptable. When Fannie and Freddie said, we're going to go after the A-minus and the B, which roughly coincides to 660 to 580 FICOs, we're going to go after those, that was a sign or signal that those FICOs are okay to really go after. And so, but the second thing that it meant, the first was a signal that these were now okay, but the second was Fannie and Freddie in 1996 roundabout, their automated underwriting comes into the fore. Mm-hmm. And they're building all of these flexibilities into this black box. Now, while it's a black box, a lot of originators kind of, you know, once you start seeing loans come through, you can sort of build based on the output. You know what's coming out. And they also allowed you to use this delegated underwriting, their black boxes, for your own business that wasn't going to them. I mean, you could put any loan through it. You didn't have to sell the loan to them. You just had to pay the fee. And so most of the business started going through over time, and it grew, started going through LP and DU. And so there was a standardization process that went through just because you knew what LP and DU would say about a loan that you originated, would it pass muster, even if you weren't going to sell it to Fannie and Freddie.
Loan prospector
and desktop underwriter.
Ed, in, let's take the time period, 2000, 2001, 2002. If I'm Acme Mortgage Originator and I'm originating mortgages, was it more profitable to me to sell to Fannie and Freddie than it is to sell to Wall Street. And why would I want to sell to Fannie and Freddie if Wall Street's interested in these mortgages?
Okay. That gets right to what's going on in page 38 and following through the... Fannie and Freddie's market share is growing during this time period, the late 90s and the early through 2003. The subprime business goes through a huge change. It had gone through a series of changes, and it relates to this originate to distribute versus originate to hold. Back in the 70s and 80s, the subprime, just like most of the rest of the business, was originate to hold. In fact, the securitization of the subprime business, I just found a great chart today from the Federal Reserve, I think, that documents the securitization percentages for government loans, Fannie Freddie, and subprime.
We're going to get that.
Government loans were 100% going back to, you know, a long time ago. Fannie and Freddie's growing. And the laggard is subprime. And then eventually subprime starts increasing.
Can you send us that chart?
That'd be great. But I think where you're going with this, tell me, back before 92, this was the universe of loans that were being underwritten. Then come affordable housing, CRA, and the like. And the universe gets bigger.
Not only gets bigger, it gets scrambled. Because back in pre-92, if you had a loan that was going to be done to Fannie Freddie standards, you would never send that loan to FHA because it would be too expensive. You wouldn't need to. Why would you pay all
that? It was a good loan.
It was a good loan.
What we're getting here is this piece gets bigger, and this is less creditworthy, arguably. Right? It's higher loan value.
Yeah, weaker loans.
Weaker loans. Now, in the old days, before securitization, everything ended up on the books of the banks.
Well, except for the subprime. Well, what do you, old days define what year?
Before 91.
Okay.
Before 92.
Okay, the subprime business, which existed, which had nothing to do with the banks, they ended up on the books of the subprime lenders, the household finances, the associates.
Terrific. Even better.
Yeah.
Subprime household. Non-bank, basically.
Household, beneficial.
Yeah.
Non-bank. Now,
although, and remember,
if we didn't have securitization, okay, and we didn't have Fannie and Freddie to sell to,
right,
all of these would have ended up
on somebody's balance sheet,
on the books of the bank, and we would have had a catastrophe a long time ago. The banks would have failed.
No, they couldn't have failed because they couldn't have enough capital.
Yeah, they would have stopped.
Right, they couldn't write. Okay, they couldn't write.
They couldn't reload.
And so even worse, exactly. What happens is this place has to find a home where it's hidden.
Yeah.
Where the losses are.
Yeah.
And where did it find? It found Fannie and Freddie. It found securities market.
Yeah.
So what's happening, and the fact that this allowed it to be hidden allowed it to get bigger.
Well, not only hidden,
until the thing
but highly busted. Leveraged.
Almost
rounds to zero. That was the second piece. Remember, I said there's the leverage on the borrower, the investor slash mechanism.
Yes.
Leverage, funding mechanism leverage, also goes to virtually zero. Close to it. Because
so back,
here, they had 10-12% capital. These guys, I'm not sure what they had, but they were, you know, fairly. They had a lot of capital to sell these. They had to sell debt to fund this stuff. It was on their books.
It's the affordable housing goals and CRA that started creating the weaker loans.
Right.
And then, because how much did Fannie Mae buy of those as a percentage?
Of what?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac of the
subprime.
Yeah, of the weaker loans.
Well, I'd have to go back and look. It's a lot. I mean, they bought 33% of all of the PMBS subprime. They bought their own batch. I mean, they ended up with a third of their loans being weak loans.
Yeah. Okay.
And then of those, that third, I've estimated that perhaps half were CRA type loans. And then on top of that, they bought the subprime, 32% of the subprime tranches. The thing back here is the market had sort of three components. You had conventional, normal, you had FHA,
and you had subprime. And these were completely compartmentalized. They were not only compartmentalized by risk, they were compartmentalized by originator. I've actually, if you look at the inside mortgage finance.
You just took a right-hand turn, and I did not follow it.
Okay. This is pre-92.
Right.
Before the GSE Act. If you were to originate a loan in 1991, you knew the day as you originated where it was going. I mean, by that I mean, was it going to be a prime loan? Was it going to be an FHA loan, which was not a prime loan? It was an A loan, a prime loan was the prime. It would be an FHA loan, which was considered, I don't know if they call it subprime, but it wasn't a prime loan. It was non-prime or subprime. Or it was going to be what was then known as subprime. And if it was, you knew what a good conventional loan looked like, a prime loan. It had LTVs of certain things. It had credit of certain things. It had debt ratios of certain things. If you had a borrower who had high debt ratios.
You could get it guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie.
What?
You could get it guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie.
If you had a borrower with a 97% LTV that wanted to purchase a home, you would never think of selling to Fannie Mae. It was by definition an FHA loan. You couldn't even get one through subprime. They didn't do those kind of loans. You could only get that loan through FHA. If, on the other hand, you wanted to do a refinance and get some cash out, with a 70% LTV and a debt ratio of 40% or 45%, and you had poor credit, you'd go here. You would never get that loan through Fannie and Freddie. It just wouldn't work. It wasn't a prime loan. And likewise, if you look at the inside mortgage finance originators, what's also interesting is all the way through 1997, there is not one of the top 25 subprime originators that are listed by Inside Mortgage Finance that, as best as I can tell, do business with Fannie Mae. Not one. Again, this demarcation is clear. What changes is in 1998. Banks start getting involved, and I can talk about that in a minute. Banks start getting involved for the first time in subprime for reasons that have to do with the crowding that's out by Fannie and Freddie, the margins getting slimmer, the competitive advantages that the banks had over these portfolio non-bank lenders, et cetera. And so what happens after the affordable housing goals get put in place, by definition, I've documented it here, Fannie and Freddie have to go up the food chain into higher risk loans. They have to start doing smaller down payments, and they do.
And well, they're instructed to.
They're instructed to. And who's their competition at that point for the higher down payment loans? FHA. And so all of a sudden, what used to be a clear demarcation point, they go into competition with FHA. I've told people, if you...
This is what Fred keeps saying.
I was chief credit officer at Fannie Mae in 1989. If you were to say to me in 1989, oh, your job is to figure out how to construct a loan that competes with FHA, I would have looked at you like you were crazy. Well, in fact, and I document it here, in 1993, Fannie Mae does precisely that. They craft a loan specifically to compete with FHA's 203B program, 97% LTV. If you were to say you need to craft a loan that would compete with subprime in terms of FICO, I would have looked at you, well, FICO didn't exist, but I would have looked at you like you were crazy. When in fact...
This started in 97?
What, Siri?
No, 97, the crowding out.
The crowding out with FHA starts in 93. The crowding out with subprime starts in about 96.
And one of the reasons for the FHA is because they're so much more expensive than a regular subprime. The insurance premium and everything else, and as it evolved, the subprime market, the margins got smaller and smaller. And therefore, FHA could not compete against
But again, what my data shows, if you focus on the purchase market,
right,
FHA's market share, and I have a chart in here, it's chart number, here it is, 22A on page 43. Their market share is fine, thank you very much, through 2000. They are not impacted.
What chart are you on?
22A on page 43. Their market share is within their historic boundaries of 10 to 15%. How do they do that? They move out the risk curve. Their LTVs get higher and higher and higher, which we've already seen. So they compete by moving out the risk curve, and they're able to keep their market share up. And so you can see, remember I said that FHA jumps from 23% of their their insured loans have down payments of 3% or less in 1997, and it jumps to 44% in 1998.
Well, that's how they rebound. You see how they get up to this 15%? They were down in the 10. They get back to 15. How do they do that? They move out the yield, the risk curve.
Yeah.
And then what does Fannie have to do? It has to move out the risk curve. And then what does subprime have to do? It has to move out the risk curve. Everybody's pushed out by either Fannie, Freddie, or...
It's not logical.
Or by FHA.
You got a system where 65% of people own houses.
And
you go to 69...
You got to find
someplace.
You have to go down the demand curve to find those people,
especially with all the incentives and the tax law and everything else for homeowners.
And that's what comes back to HUD's role.
And
HUD in 99, ultimately it affects 2001, but they announce it in 99 and tell people it's going to take effect in 2000. They tell Fannie and Freddie, we're going from 40% to 48, I think was what it was. They say we're going to go to 48% in 2000. They end up not doing that.
48% of?
Low and mod, has to be low and mod. But again, the big increase is in the special affordable, the below 80.
That's where they got to go. That's where the new home buyers are.
That's where the new home buyers are, is with the small down payments and the poor credit and everything else. So what happens, and this I just discovered over the weekend, you've heard me say that one of the drivers of CRA, and CRA was involved in this in many, many different ways, which I've been saying for some time, but I am now finding other facets to it. What happened with CRA, you've heard me say that CRA drove or enabled the banks to merge, because in order to be able to merge, they had to have good CRA ratings. And that's why 94% of all of the CRA commitments that were announced on that NCRC book can be traced to four banks and banks they purchased. And you know who the four banks are. The other thing that I found this weekend was that in 1997, there are no banks involved in subprime that I can find. If you look inside mortgage finance, there just aren't any. They're all either the old school non-bank portfolio lenders like Beneficial and Household, or they're the new school Countrywide starting to come, but they're really an oddball because they do everything. But other than Countrywide, they're all very compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. They don't do anything but subprime. The Conti mortgage is really the example. And I've got an article that Tom LaMalfa just gave me. He did an exhaustive study of the subprime industry as of January 1996, based on surveys of 30 different originators.
Could you send us a copy of that?
Yeah, subprime study. Some of this stuff I've just gotten in the last few days.
And who was that by?
Tom LaMalfa.
Oh, okay.
So it was published in Mortgage Banking Magazine, and I believe it was in the beginning of 96, but they amassed all kinds of data, including margins. The basic question they were trying to figure out is, are they raping and pillaging on margins, or are these margins necessary because the loans are risky? And they basically conclude that these margins are necessary because, A, the loans are risky, and, B, they prepay very quickly. And, therefore, you don't get these margins for very long. But you have losses. The losses you always have with you. And so you have to basically cover your losses somehow with these margins. And so what I found was that there was a very rapid change in the subprime market. The first stage was slower. It was the shift from the traditional to the Conti mortgage types. But then in 98, remember, in 97, there are no commercial banks, what I call retail commercial banks, because retail commercial banks are really who's subject to CRA. I mean, that's who's it. And so there are no retail commercial banks or thrifts involved in subprime in 97. In 98, the first one appears, it's First Union, and they buy the money store. Mm-hmm. In 1999, and if you go
Hang
to...
Hang on, we go slowly. Up until 98, no banks or thrifts were engaged in subprime.
As evidenced by being in the top 25. Now, there may have been under the radar, in terms of... But it's a very...
Not in a big way.
Not in a big way. In 1999, there are seven bank holding companies that have participation in subprime. And they account for 23% market share, which is really, it goes from nothing.
Zero to 23.
Zero to 23 in 2 years.
Who bought the money?
It's a drag race.
The First Union buys the money store.
First Union in 98,
March.
Dick, this is relevant to what you and I are talking about, your piece of the...
The 7R, Bank of America, is number one, believe it or not. How they get to be number one out of nowhere. I couldn't find they bought anybody. I've got a source that I'm trying to track down that might be able to explain it. But they had a 9.1% market share and gave them the number one position in 1999. Citibank has got a 3.9 share. First Franklin, which was purchased by Nat City in 1999, has a 2.8 market share. First Union, which had purchased the money store the year before, is a 2.7. Long Beach Mortgage was purchased by WaMu with a 2% share. Chase Manhattan had a 1.7 share. And Norwest, which had been purchased by Wells Fargo in 98, had a 0.9% share. That adds up to the 23% share.
This is the year in 1999 that all the regulators come out with their new subprime guidelines.
Right, it is. But what I then looked at, as I said, what's the relationship between CRA and this? And it turns out, and this is what I was just absolutely striking about three things, that every one of these seven has a long and large history in CRA. By long, I mean going back a decade or more. And I'm actually putting a chart. I've got all the data. I just haven't put it in a chart form. A long and large history in CRA. In fact, based on the NCRC data, there was $1.169 trillion
of CRA commitments through 1998. Total. Of those... 93% are from those seven banks or banks they had acquired.
Say that one more time.
Okay. As
they were fulfilling their commitments.
Through, no.
No?
Because these loans don't actually go to fulfill the commitment.
Okay.
Through 1998, if you look at the NCRC data, there are publicly announced commitments for $1.169 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the seven banks, bank holding companies, that ended up out of nowhere controlling 23% of the subprime market out of nowhere in 2 years. And 93% ends up being, of this number, ends up being those seven banks or banks that, like Norwest, was purchased by
So
Chase.
They had written them before, they just were reporting them separately.
No.
No? Okay, well,
I believe...
They read it all 98.
I believe CRA was the training wheels for getting into Lucent Lending. It's the way you got introduced to Lucent Lending. Because that's what CRA was, Lucent Lending. Higher down payments, lower down payments, higher ratios. I mean, all the things, these banks, some of them go back to the 80s.
But it wasn't the training. I think it's the blessing. It was the blessing that has
I think they saw a business opportunity. I think they go, you know, we see these borrowers come in. We actually have to lend to them below market. Because that's what, and I proved that they were subsidizing them. The banks were subsidizing CRA lending. Forget what the Fed study showed, because what it actually shows is that it was being subsidized. And I believe what they see is, wait a minute, there's a business opportunity here. We've seen this demand come in. We have to do it under CRA. We could meet this demand over here through non-bank subsidiaries. We've already got exposure to this. We've got people who are credit people who are aware of this. We can do these loans. And they've been pushed and pushed and pushed. The crowding out by Fannie and Freddie is absolutely key, because the margins, and I found an article that says the reason, and I can't remember whether it's First Union or Nat City, the reason one of them bought it was because the mortgage spreads had gotten narrower, mortgages had gotten commoditized, which, read Fannie Freddie, and the subprime market was where the spreads were wide. And the banks had a big funding advantage over these non-bank subprime. These were funding them with debentures, the equivalent of debt.
Yeah.
And they were
corporate debt.
Corporate debt, and it wasn't very highly rated, so they were paying big spreads. Well, the banks could fund it with deposits and corporate debt. And Wells Fargo, for example, was AAA rated at this point, and so they could actually fund it much more efficiently. And so that's why you have them buying. So First Union buys Money Store for $2.1 billion. And the article says, they think they didn't overpay,
because they can pick up all the spread when they shift to their funding that was going to the private debt. And so the other thing that's interesting is that these seven really become the core. Nobody gets added to it. I mean, there's the only things, IndyMac, but IndyMac isn't a retail bank. There's NetBank. NetBank's not a retail bank. So of the retail banks, these seven are it. They eventually grow to about 35% of the whole subprime market. And then you have Wall Street coming in after them. And Wall Street starts buying, but it's later. Wall Street starts buying. I haven't even gotten to documenting that, but Goldman Sachs buys somebody, and this buys somebody, and somebody buys somebody. And so you end up having a lot of the subprime being owned by 30-something percent of it is banks, bank holding companies, and another, again, I haven't added up the Wall Street piece, but it might be another 10 or 12 I have to add it up, is Wall Street, and then you have GE owns a little bit, and you've got AIG owns somebody. And so this is no longer the business that was being done in the 70s and 80s and 90s. This is now, they're owned by large financial companies because the spreads look to be huge compared to what's left. And Tom Wamalfa has written about this when he talked about Fannie and Freddie were sucking out the profits, the lion's share of the profits. And what was left was you either lived with low margins or you moved out the risk curve. The problem was Fannie and Freddie then moved out the risk curve.
Yeah.
And so you had everybody going in the same direction because HUD was pushing everybody in the same direction. So
Because they were pushing.
They were pushing them down the demand curve, which
Fannie and Freddie, which
pushed everybody.
Yeah.
And so that's the subprime history.
Who had cheaper funding than anybody.
And who had cheaper funding than anybody until the next piece of the puzzle, which is all brand new, is the CDO. And this is, again, Countrywide is smack in the center of this. Countrywide was the only entity that put it all together from beginning to end. They had complete vertical integration. In 2006 or something, they were the largest originator in the United States. They were the second largest retail originator. They were the largest correspondent originator. They were the largest broker originator. They were the largest servicer. They were the largest seller to Fannie and Freddie. They were the second largest all-day originator. They were the third or fourth largest subprime originator. They were the largest issuer of private mortgage-backed securities, and they were the third largest underwriter of private mortgage-backed securities. There was nobody else in the marketplace that wore all those hats to with the market penetration that they had, period. Yet everyone else was jealous of them. WaMu basically had to throw up their hands and sort of move to pay option arms. They had no choice. They basically concluded they couldn't compete with them on all the other stuff, and they just moved to pay option arms, you know, and they died on pay option arms. Others decided to move to all day, and then they died on all day. I mean, there's all these unintended consequences that are going on. And so Countrywide is there, and so what does so some lenders try to compete with Countrywide, but in particular Wall Street tries to compete with Countrywide.
Go ahead.
Bear Stearns tries to. Lehman Brothers goes buys the Colorado company,
right. Aurora,
and Bear Stearns buys whoever Bear Stearns buys, and others buy different things in trying to move forward. And then you've got that document that I think you've seen, the Fannie Mae Crossroads document from 1994, 1995, where Fannie basically describes the marketplace in 1994, 95, and basically says the big risk to Fannie and Freddie by the 2004, 2005, I'm sorry. The big risk to Fannie and Freddie is that these soup to nuts, these vertically integrated entities, mm-hmm. will offer an all-in price. You know what an all-in price is? You got 100 loans that you're originating? We'll buy them all. Don't bother trying to figure out which ones are going to go to Fannie and which ones are going to go to Freddie and which ones are going to go to private securities and which ones are going to...
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure all that. We'll make you an all-in price for them all. And you see in that document, Fannie is basically absolutely concerned about that. How do they get to the point where they're concerned about all-in? Somebody could actually give all-in pricing, which Countrywide is doing. Remember, Countrywide's got Fannie and Freddie's DU and LP. They know exactly, by back engineering, what the approval process is. So if you go to page... By the way, page 42 has that...
press release from Quicken with the actual language. And you'll see that for on down payments, you'll see that it's a minimum that many are significantly lower than required for subprime loans, the down payments. But those that's the actual verbatim language out of the press release. If you go to in the 2000 year on page 44, and this gets to Cuomo, there's some amazing language in the actual rule promulgation. Besides the fact that he wants them to get a minor, he pushes them into subprime, which again, those would be questions. You know, what was your intent? You know, when you said here that you wanted them to go into subprime, he ultimately says because the GSEs. At the bottom of page 45, this is the crowding out. He says, HUD says the crowding out in their own terms. Because the GSEs have a funding advantage over other market participants, they have the ability...
He's on page 45, very bottom. In the bottom paragraph, bold print.
Because the GSEs have a funding advantage over other market participants, they have the ability to underprice their competitors and increase their market share. This advantage, as has been the case in the prime market, could allow the GSEs to eventually play a significant role in the subprime market. As the GSEs become more comfortable with subprime lending, the line between, this is the thing I referred to earlier, what is today considered a subprime loan versus a prime loan will likely deteriorate, making expansion by the GSEs look more like an increase in the prime market, emphasis mine. I've been saying that but here's HUD saying it in 2000. They actually predict what ultimately happens. And this whole idea that HUD basically says, we're going to use Fannie and Freddie's competitive advantage, which they've used to squeeze out their competitors in the prime market, we're now going to tell them to do that in the subprime market. Think about that. It's declaring war on the subprime lenders and saying it's a battle. And it's a battle that Fannie and Freddie lose for a time. They win. I mean, I showed how they gain share, but then in 2004, for a reason I'm going to come to, they lose. Then page 46, the next bolded, lending to credit-impaired borrowers will in turn increasingly make good business sense for the mortgage market. I mean, he is encouraging the market to go to subprime. In fact, back to that document from Fannie's foundation, they actually say one of the problems with Countrywide is they sell all their loans to Fannie and Freddie. Think about this. The Fannie Mae Foundation says, the problem with Countrywide, they need to develop their own independent ways of doing lending to low and moderate income borrowers that have underwriting criteria beyond what Fannie and Freddie will accept. I mean, that's under the old thing, may your wishes come true, you know, Chinese curse. Yeah. Well, that's what happens in 2004.
So you're saying before 2004, Countrywide sold all their subprime stuff?
No, they sold virtually, this is in 2000. That document, the Crossroads document, documents what percentage of Countrywide's business is going to Fannie and Freddie, what's going to Fannie, and then you can figure out what's going to Freddie. But it's almost, they're doing subprime, but it's relatively small.
All their stuff was going...
Not all of it, but the vast majority of their business is going to Fannie and Freddie. Yes, there is some subprime that's being put out over here, but they're not a big player. Yeah.
Okay.
But what they were selling to Fannie and Freddie were subprime mortgages, though.
Called prime.
Affordable housing mortgages.
Because and again, this is in my exhibits, ultimately, Countrywide originates $789 billion of the loans under that $1 trillion commitment. And the only reason that they didn't hit the trillion is because they hit the wall. The trillion was announced in 05 or 06. They hit the wall shortly thereafter, and then they stopped counting. And so at the point they stopped counting, they were at 780-something billion. So the... HUD has this regulatory regime that is actually forcing people into a race to the bottom. Everybody's being pushed in the same direction.
By design.
But then you have, on page 44... Page 48, you have a absolutely key development. Up to this point, it's very hard for the private mortgage-backed security market to compete with Fannie and Freddie because the amount of AAA that you need and AA you need is still relatively high. which means that you have a lot of pieces that the amount of credit backup behind the AAA and the AA is still relatively high, which means you end up with a lot of pieces below AA, and you end up with a lot of pieces below investment grade, a lot of tranches. Mm-hmm. And that keeps the spreads high because those have to give
you...
You've got to over-collateralize. You've got to give them more yield. You got to protect the AAA. And what I found was a series of articles, and I've got these charts.
What's your quote here on 48 that I'm supposed to...
No, there's not a quote. It's just it starts on page 48. Okay. The banking regulators in November 2001 changed the rule for the weighting of AAA and AA tranches that had been established in 1988. They changed it...
Back up. Just tell me what you just said.
In November 2001, you know the risk-based capital rules,
right.
Said that back in 88, said that if you're Fannie Freddie MBS, you need 20% of 8% or 1.6%. It was a 20% weight. Mm-hmm. If you're a mortgage, and it was a qualified mortgage, whatever that was, if it was a residential mortgage, blah, 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 you needed a weight of 50%, which is 4%. If you were a AAA or AA tranche, you needed 8%. Of a private mortgage-backed security. You needed 8%. They just said that. In 2001 November, they changed the rule for the AA and AAA tranche to 20% to match Fannie and Freddie. As best that I can tell, it didn't have a huge
impact.
They
increased it,
No, they decreased it from 100% to 20%.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So it went from 8%, which was the normal,
right,
to 20%. If you had you're now a bank, you could all of a sudden, if you had AAA tranches, private mortgage-backed securities, your capital requirement went from 8% to 1.6% overnight on January 1st, 2002.
Mm. For AAA and AA tranches.
AAA and AA tranches. But as best as I can tell, it did not cause a stampede of banks into AAA. It may have caused an increase into AA, but remember, who are the huge, biggest buyers of the AAA?
Citigroup.
Fannie Freddie
and the Flubs.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the only things they can buy by their own program design is AAA. And so, again, I don't know if this is correct or not, but yes, the banks can now get this much lower capital requirement, but the AAAs are hard to come by because Fannie and Freddie are the biggest, and the Flubs are the biggest. They don't buy AA, so there's maybe some AAs they could buy, and maybe they do buy a lot of AAs, but there aren't that many AAs out there. Mm-hmm. The whole point of how this securitization process goes, everything shifts to AAA. The yield of AAA out of the PMBS goes to a very high percentage. And so if you look at the chart on page 50, single-family CDOs in a growing CDO market. The CDO market is the total volume of CDOs is the black line, and single-family share of CDOs is the purple or the purple columns. And so you can see there's
single-family mortgage.
Single-family mortgage is backing CDOs.
Gotcha.
And so you see that the black line, is $50 billion, $60 billion, in the early part of the aught years. It's not huge, and it takes off. But this understates, and I'll come to that, back to that, it understates the role of CDOs for a reason I'll come back to. But the share of whatever CDOs are being done is moving more and more towards the single family. Now, you had a person testify from Moody's at one of your hearings,
mm-hmm.
and he put his finger on why the CDO in single family exploded. And the way I interpreted what he said was, we had a group called, this is at Moody's, we had a group called the mortgage-backed securities, single family mortgage-backed securities group. They rated those securities. When they told us the tranche was X, we took it as X. They told us it was Y, we took it as Y. We didn't re-examine those ratings. That was their job. Our job in the CDO area, and we had learned this with corporates, and I have a chart in here. I don't have a chart on that, but corporates was where CDOs got started, corporate securities. We had a basic rule that said if you took things that had a certain rating and you diversified, you could reduce the amount of credit support behind those ratings because of the diversification. Well, We got a bunch of ratings from the mortgage side. We applied our rule, and all of a sudden we went from requiring this much backing it to this much backing it. We didn't think about what was going on with the original.
Or the fact that corporate debt and.
Yeah, or the fact that the
housing loans were different.
And the housing loans were correlated, much more correlated. And I actually talked to somebody at lunch with somebody the other day, two different people who were in the guarantee business, the bond guarantee business back in the early 2000s. And while they were this far removed from the CDO market, they weren't creating CDOs, but they were seeing them.
Similar thing.
And they basically said, oh, yeah, we saw that that was what was going on, and we saw that that's how they got to this reduction in coverage or backup.
Over-collateralization.
Reduction in collateralization, et cetera, mm-hmm. and got to more AAA.
Right.
And so the next chart... Basically, from a different source, this shows the commercial bank, FHLB, and Fannie Freddie outstandings. This is based on where did I get this information from?
Private MBS, yes.
Yeah, for holding a private MBS, that's off of Federal Home Loan Bank. The FHLB's holdings is, I have to think about where I got this. I thought I had this. Inside Mortgage Finance, yeah. And then Commercial Bank and Thrift Holdings, the private MBS, is out of the federal sources. I got to add that. Or out of the flow of funds. Okay, so what you see is, remember the reason I put this in here is because for two reasons. One is that bank change that took place January 1st, 2002. You see the bank's share actually goes down. But it made
January 1st, 2002. I thought you said November 2001.
It's announced. The final rule is announced. It takes effect January 1st.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay.
And so their share goes down, which seems a bit odd. But again, mm-hmm. It could be because Fannie and Freddie share is going up, and they're focusing entirely on AAA. And when they're focusing on AAA, think about it. A, they didn't buy anything below AAA. And even there were 5 or 6 or 7% of the issues, you know, even with all the CDO stuff, had ratings below AAA. They didn't buy anything that was non-conforming, and about 8 or 9% of the subprime was non-conforming. And so they bought...
Only 8 or 9% was non-conforming?
Of the subprime.
Only 8 or 9% of subprime were non-conforming?
In dollar amount.
When originally issued.
When originally issued, yeah.
Only, though.
Yeah. It might have been 10. If you go to that...
But 90% or greater of subprime mortgages were actually conforming.
Yeah, conforming, yeah. If you go back to my...
They might have been on original issuance.
Yeah, on original issues. The subprimes were low...
They haven't had time to default yet.
Yeah.
Or get behind the payment.
No. They were in size. Mm-hmm. See, unlike the all day...
Yeah, they were under the...
They were under the 300,000 limit,
and so.
But the point is, if Fannie and Freddie bought 35% of the AAA, they were really buying 42 or 43% of everything they could buy. They couldn't buy the AA, they couldn't buy the single B, they couldn't buy the triple B, they couldn't buy anything that was other than AAA. They couldn't buy anything that was non-conforming in loan size. And so they, of the AAA they could buy, they were even a bigger player. And then you throw in the FHLBs. And the FHLBs were not an inconsiderable player. And then the banks themselves were not inconsiderable. So if you look at this, you'll see that based on the source of funds data, that half of the entire PMBS purchases are being made by Fannie, Freddie, the FHLBs, and the banks. That leaves the other half, and I go through, the Federal Home Loan Bank flow of funds data gets a little vague mm-hmm. once you get beyond about the first 5 or 6, and so some of it's overseas. But again, a big chunk of it is right in these three. And
before you even talk about CDOs, you're saying 50% going to this, there's another chunk going overseas, and then the remainder is going into CDOs.
Right.
So back basically.
Yeah, this doesn't include any CDOs because Fannie's not buying. I don't think Fannie and Freddie bought any CDOs. I don't think the FHLBs bought any CDOs, and I'm not sure the banks were buying CDOs.
Well, the banks. These
banks
are creating CDOs, right?
They're creating CDOs, but they're not necessarily. These are PMBS holdings.
They wouldn't turn into CDOs?
Well, again, the thing about the CDOs is. And let's go to the next chart.
What is the conclusion, though,
that you're taking away from chart 24. I don't think I follow your conclusion.
My conclusion is that Fannie and Freddie and the FHLBs, to a lesser extent, are the one constant in this marketplace in terms of demand from 2002 through 2005. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the way the state is reported, the way Inside Mortgage Finance reports it, 2006 you can't get at the same way, so I'm stuck with this. Certainly their percentage goes down some in 2006, but I can't get to it from the Inside Mortgage Finance data. But by 2006, it's all over but for the shouting. I mean, 2006 is really the end of the, virtually, of the subprime.
The end of days.
The end of the, yeah. And so these are the core years, 02 through 05. And it basically shows the role. When people say, well, wait a minute, Fannie and Freddie, they were only buying the AAA. The point is that the vast majority, because of the CDO process, the vast majority of the PMBS end up being AAA. And then what wasn't AAA gets recycled into AAA through the CDO process. And that's shown on chart 25.
Have you done any study, or do you have any input? And this is a pet peeve of mine with respect to CDOs. Whether or not the majority of them were sold pursuant to Regulation D or 144A or sold in tranches.
They had to be sold in tranches because that's what they were.
Well, what I mean was I misstated it.
Well, in fact, the tranches are right here.
He means they were shelf registered.
Shelf registration.
Oh, yeah. CDOs, all of them were Reg D. Yeah. I mean, all of them were 144A, excuse me. All of them were 144A. Tom?
All?
Practically all CDOs were 144A CDOs. Yes, I can talk offline, but I can tell you that CDOs were not registered. Very, very few of them.
So they're all private offerings.
Yes, very, very few of them were registered. But conversely, very few RMBS offerings, private mortgage-backed
right.
securities. Conversely, very few of them were unregistered.
That's
most of the private mortgage-backed securities offerings were registered, but the CDOs were not. They were private offerings.
But they were 144A's.
Qualified institutional purchasers. 144A's. Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then they were dumped in all the damn high-yield mutual funds who didn't know what the hell they were anyway.
Well, and again, that you had this AAA, AA, and that was driving everybody who wanted the security, the safety of AAA, AA.
Yeah.
The original PMBS had yielded about 80% AAA and 11% AA. And then you had this 9% that was below AA. Well, then when you CDO'd them, the stuff that you got, this on chart 25, 85% in 2006 of the output of a CDO was AAA, and another 7.5% was AA. So you had 92, whatever went into the CDO, 92.5% came out as AA, AAA.
Yeah, but I just want to be clear here, Ed. A lot of the CDOs, though, were MES CDOs. So they were triple B.
Right.
Private mortgage-backed securities that went in, and because they were restructured,
right.
comes out as AAA.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
These are, it says down here, they were from, the ratings distribution 107, let's see.
But help me understand, what is the significance of chart 25, what is the conclusion you're trying to draw?
The conclusion I'm trying to draw is that the drive in the marketplace, in the PMBS marketplace, mm-hmm. is to create more and more AAA out of, if you start with $1 billion of PMBS, you want to get to a high, whatever the final yield of that is, you want as much AAA as possible with a much smaller amount of AA, and then as little of the rest. What was going on, what was holding back the private securitization was they were ending up with all these mezzanine pieces that had to be home, they had to have homes for them, and there wasn't as much demand. Fannie didn't buy them, the Flubs didn't buy them, Freddie didn't buy them.
The purpose of the CBO was to get rid of those things.
The purpose of the CBO was to convert them into AA and AAA to create demand for them and to create a market for them. And as that took place,
take the cats and dogs, put them in a vehicle that gives you a AAA rating.
As that took place, the leverage advantage that the PMBS had compared to Fannie and Freddie, as the CDOs spread through the private mortgage-backed residential industry, it created, it narrowed the spreads on the private mortgage-backed securities. And made them more competitive with Fannie and Freddie. So by 2004, you've got Countrywide, remember, is the number one issuer of PMBS, the number three underwriter. If you go to chart, let me just go two more charts. In 26, it shows the percentage of bonds that are going into CDOs. Now remember, you didn't have to have all of the tranches of a PMBS go into a CDO to get the bang. You had to have the mezzanine tranches go in, and this is showing that by 2004, almost 80% of all of the PMBS have a portion of their tranches going into a CDO. So even though the CDO is only affecting 5% of the business, it's touching 75% of the PMBSs because it's focusing on those mezzanine pieces, which are the ones that were hard to sell and had the...
Where did you get this chart?
Yeah.
Jim Hugh. Let's see.
Okay.
Footnote 114?
Footnote 114, yeah.
Okay.
Who is Jim Hugh?
He was with Moody's. I mean, it's a great article because he confirms in that article about the, and I have a quote in here, confirms that it was the diversification argument, which was what they focused on. He was in the CDO operation.
So as the CDO market grew, I mean, more and more, when you say percent of bonds in CDOs, you mean
rated PMBS below A. So see, this goes back to your point. If you read the headline on 26, percentage of mezzanine tranches
rated below A.
Below A, that's going in from subprime MBS that is either in or not in CDOs. But remember, they didn't.
So they weren't even trying to sell those things. They were just keeping them alive to put in CDOs.
Yes.
But is your point here? Is your point here that CDOs were an after effect, were an afterthought to provide a source for the mezzanine tranches and what we're driving private?
No, I think as AAA issuances grew, plus percentage-wise they weren't growing, but volume-wise they were growing because the market was growing hugely in the early part of the aught years. And so remember the market grew from $1 trillion in 2000 or whatever to $2 trillion to $3 trillion to $4 trillion by 2003. So while the subprime market is percentage wise staying constant, it's a percentage of a huge, actually sliding down a slight amount, but it's a percentage of a hugely increasing market. And so it's generating all these mezzanine pieces that they're having a hard time finding a home for.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, somebody comes up with the bright idea, if we take what we did in the corporate arena.
Yeah, like we did on November 1st, 2001 with the banking.
Yeah, and we do it with these mezzanine tranches, and we turn them into CDOs. You see the trend if you look at all these different charts. You see, go back to chart. I'm just piecing things back to chart 23. Jeez. You see the volume of CDOs, is growing. Yeah. But the percentage is growing slowly. But the percentage that's going into housing is increasing, and you see who's buying them in chart 24 is consistently Fannie, Freddie, and the Flubs, and then you see the dollar volume of how you can convert those mezzanine pieces into AAA and AA at a very high percentage, 92.5%, and then you see chart 26 that the percentage of bonds, the mezzanine bond tranches that are getting utilized and going into CDOs goes from 20% in 2001 when the volume is much lower the dollar volume, but then it gets higher and higher, and eventually, in a very short order, it goes from 20% to almost 80%. And so all of a sudden, you have solved the problem of what to do with all these mezzanine tranches. You turn them into CDOs.
But, okay, could the argument be made, though, Ed, that in 2003 or 2004, that the demand for private label mortgage-backed securities was driven by the CDOs? Because what I hear you saying, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, is that CDOs were the tail of the dog. But my question is...
They were enabler. They allowed the private mortgage-backed securities to expand way beyond where it had been because it provided liquidity for the mezzanine pieces.
Okay.
And that liquidity is traced through these charts.
They were the poop at the end of the securitization process.
And I believe, let me go one step further, and I've got somebody that's trying to put this together for me. And again, that's why I think Countrywide is the set piece for this, because they're the ones that are... Oh, one more chart. Where's that chart? Oh, it's back here. Page 58. Remember, who are the issuers of the CDOs? The issuers, the banks under the underwriters of the CDOs, investment banks, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, et cetera, et cetera. This is in rank order by the number of CDOs they issued. 697 CDOs issued. Page 58.
What year is this?
Chart is, but mm-hmm. it was.
What's the source of this?
What is it? 120. So Harvard.
Oh, the Harvard student.
Yeah, yes. Harvard
uh-huh.
student.
No.
Which looked to be a very well done chart piece. Notice that the largest residential supplier, except in one case, is Countrywide. Countrywide is providing the raw materials of the tranches. So even though Countrywide is the largest issuer, remember it's the largest issuer of RMBS, but is only the third largest underwriter. And so it can't sell everything it's producing.
Right.
It ends up with a lot of mezzanine pieces that it needs to get rid of.
Yep.
It gets rid of them by selling them to all of these places.
And they want to get it off their balance sheet for capital purposes. They want to get it out the door.
But I believe,
anyhow.
And I I'm trying to track this down. I believe that, as you know, there was a piece below the mezzanine piece, the toxic waste.
Yes.
And I believe...
The equity tranches.
Right.
And you had to find a home for those, too. And so you either had them on your balance sheet, or I think in Countrywide's case, I'm not certain of this...
They weren't that big, were they?
They weren't that big, but the volume starts getting very big.
Well, are we talking the residual tranche of RMBS, or are we talking about the equity tranche?
I think we're talking about the equity... No, the residual tranche
of RMBS.
RMBS.
Yeah, because the lowest tranche is... termed residual on the private mortgage-backed securities, and on the CDO side, it's called equity because the CDO managers were buying the equity tranches of their CDOs.
Right.
But in terms of the residual tranches of RMBS, that's a different question.
Yeah, and I'm not sure which one I'm talking about here for Countrywide's case, but I believe Countrywide had a bank called Treasury Bank. And as best as I can tell, and it became a larger and larger factor in Countrywide's operation, it became a huge counterparty to the Federal Home Loan Banks in terms of pledging loans and getting back under their advance program, pledging loans and getting back advances. But before that, that was late in the game. Before that, I believe the Treasury Bank had two potential functions. Again, it was not a consumer bank. It was basically the private FDIC bank of Countrywide, more or less. But it had a huge source of deposits, I believe, and that was the escrows. Remember who's the largest servicer in the country.
Ah. Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
So I believe, and I haven't been able to nail this down, but it may be that Countrywide moved... That's the it makes sense. They would move their escrows to their Treasury Bank, which gave them an immediate huge amount of deposits because they're the largest servicer in the country. The second step is I believe they may have had the Treasury Bank investing in these private these equity pieces, whatever they were called, in either the PMBS tranches, you know, the equity, the unrated pieces, completely unrated pieces, or the equity pieces in the CDO. I haven't gotten down to which ones they might be, but I think there might be a connection there, because clearly Countrywide was able to liquefy the mezzanine pieces, as evidenced by chart 29. They were selling them back. And the way I describe CDO, and I have an example in here, and it's just an example I came up with. The CDOs didn't create any more MBS. Forget about the cash versus, you know, the fictitious CDOs. I mean, I'm not even talking about those. Mm-hmm. But they didn't create any more MBS. They enabled the creation of more MBS, but they didn't create any more. And the example is you have a petroleum refinery, and it cracks petroleum. And it takes a barrel of oil and turns it into all this stuff that's now more valuable than as a barrel of crude. It doesn't create any more crude, and it doesn't create any more supply of crude, but it creates a tremendous demand for crude, which then you go out and find more crude, and then you run it through the cracking tower. And again, you don't add another barrel, but you get more yield. And that's my analogy of what CDOs did. It didn't create any more PMBS because the raw materials for CDOs were these tranches of PMBS. Mm-hmm. It didn't multiply them. It just made them more efficient by allowing them to be sold at AAA and AA spreads.
A byproduct of the cracking process.
It was a byproduct. Yeah. And then that making those byproducts created more demand for the original PMBS, which then created more CDOs, which then, you know, fed back a feedback loop. So that's my...
They had to do something with it.
And they only had
so much storage capacity.
They had only so much storage capacity. They would have run out of space, storage capacity, if it hadn't been for the CDO. And then CDO squared took it to the next step. And again, this is all separate from the phantom, the fictitious ones.
Ed, forgive me, I'm going to have to leave here myself shortly, but let me ask you just this question, just so I can understand. In 2000 and let's just say 2003, 2004, 2005 time period, I'm a mortgage originator. Let's just say I'm located in California, and I am selling pools of mortgage loans or trying to establish a place to sell my mortgages. Why does Fannie have a competitive advantage versus Wall Street buying those mortgages? Or conversely, why, or stated differently, I should say, why am I, a mortgage originator, better off selling my mortgages, subprime mortgages, to Fannie versus selling them off to Wall Street?
Okay, it comes down to a lot of different things, but again, we're talking 2003 and before and post-2003.
Okay.
2003 and before, Fannie and Freddie are the king of the mountain. Their market share is going up in the huge year 2003, $4 trillion. Their market share reaches the most it ever would reach until recent history. Mm-hmm. They ride a wave of fixed rate mortgages. They are if you're going to do a fixed rate 30-year fixed rate mortgage, you know, you're going to sell it more or less to Fannie and Freddie.
Why?
Because the banks don't want to hold a 30-year fixed rate mortgage as a whole loan on their balance sheet by and large. The capital reasons, and it's just too long. I mean, it's got too long a duration. Fannie and Freddie are the masters of funding 30-year fixed-rate mortgages.
But let's say I'm an originator, a mortgage banker.
Yeah.
Price.
Mortgage banker.
If you've got a borrower that you can originate a fixed-rate...
Not a bank, so I'm not holding anything.
You're not holding it, but you're Countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make you Countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, again, is mm-hmm. again, Countrywide is growing by leaps and bounds during this time period. And you have a borrower that you can put into a fixed rate. Your first choice, if you can put them into a fixed rate and sell it to Fannie and Freddie, that's going to be the easiest sell for that customer, the easiest way to originate that loan and move it off to Fannie and Freddie. Their FICO may be 580, 590, but you can put them into a fixed rate and move it off to Fannie and Freddie. If you can put them into an Alt-A loan, and again, you know what Fannie and Freddie will buy, you can do that.
Because you have an instant buyer.
You've got an instant buyer. You run it through
the time of origination, you have an instant buyer.
And you've got an instant price. You know exactly what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in 2003, Fannie and Freddie are getting most of the business. You have to subtract the jumbo because they're not in the jumbo market.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you subtract the jumbo, FHA is a relatively small piece. If you've got 25% of the market by dollars are jumbo,
and Fannie and Freddie are getting what they're getting out of the remaining 75%. And out of that remaining 75%, they've got most, a very high percentage of it, well over half. I mean, they're half of the entire market, so think of what they are of the non, the conforming portion. Again, FHA is just a relatively small piece in 2004 and 2003. But in 2004, things shift to ARMs. You have this affordability gap. You have all the things I've talked about in terms of the perfect storm. And you now have a means for actually competing with Fannie and Freddie because of the CDO coming in to the fore. And Countrywide, and if you look at that, again, that 2004-2005 document from Fannie, it talks about the role of CDOs and what Countrywide's doing. And I have a quote in here that talks about that. I think, what page is that on?
48, one.
Oh, by the way, if you don't believe what I say about FHA and the competition, on page 55,
48.
Franklin Raines takes a victory lap in April 2002. Think about this. As a result of both congressionally mandated lending requirements and our own $2 trillion American Dream commitment, which was required by mandated lending requirements, Fannie Mae has not so quietly become the largest single provider of mortgage funds to minority and low-income households, its chairman declared last week. Quote, not only is Fannie Mae, quote, by far the largest supplier of mortgage money in the private sector, Franklin Raines proclaimed, the Federal Chartered Corporation is running, quote, neck and neck, close quote, with FHA as the chief source of public funding for housing. Think about that.
The government is our only competitor.
The government is, and then he goes on to say the government is our only competitor. Now, think about that. First, this is a private company calling itself a chief source of public funding for housing. Think about how perverted the view is at Fannie Mae when they say that. And then he goes on to say, and the government is the only competitor, and so he just said he's public source of funding, of a public source. He is the government. Mm. And of course, FHA's market share is in a tailspin from that point on. When FHA says, oh, they avoided this because they did that and did that, FHA avoided it because Fannie and Freddie were nipping at their heels and had basically crowded them out, and they couldn't keep up.
Okay.
But what was your...
Okay, post-2003, though,
mm-hmm.
with the advent of Alt-A mortgages.
Right.
That sounds to me like you're suggesting that the financial crisis was caused by Alt-A and driven by the purchases from Wall Street.
No, what I'm saying is the financial crisis was caused by a sequential loosening of underwriting standards over a period of 15 or 16 years that culminates in the perfect storm in 2004, whereby Fannie, Freddie, participating in all the stuff they participated in, including Alt-A, including buying prime loans that were disguised subprime loans, including buying 30-plus percent of the subprime tranches, 11 or 12% of the Alt-A tranches, and everything else that they did, along with the private sector doing the PMBS, the remaining subprime and Alt-A private mortgage-backed securities, plus the banks doing option ARMs, which WAMU was basically left with as the only place they had left that they could earn spreads that passed their hurdle. And the market, the underwriting had been so weakened by FHA sending out these signals in that 1999, their standards, that, in fact, I have a quote here from 97, that going to zero down payment, which occurred in 2000, going to debt ratios of 40 to 50% was okay, mm-hmm. going to FICO scores, no minimum FICO scores, so any FICO scores were fine, and then it was a short leap to Alt-A, which Fannie and Freddie were the huge participants in on a unit basis, and then subprime, PMBS, yes, they were participants in it, but they got pushed out in 04, 05, and then came back. But all of that together led to a weakening of the entire system.
What evidence do you have that Fannie and Freddie got into Alt-A to meet affordable housing goals versus competing with Wall Street that was getting into Alt-A? That may be my last question.
I don't have that in here. It's in one of the appendices that I've got, but I have a whole appendix.
Can you send that?
On Alt-A. I come at it from two directions. One is qualitative or anecdotal, and one is quantitative. Anecdotally, I've got a series of quotes from people at Fannie and Freddie that talk about the importance of Alt-A in the goals from different time periods. But secondly, I go through, and again, you could ask questions about this. HUD publishes information that allows you to figure out sort of how where the sources of the small rentals are coming from, the 1-4s, and how many there were. And if you do the math, you can't get the lion's share of those unless you include the Alt-A. The Alt-A is such a huge percentage of those type of loans, and you can get that from from Fannie's own report that's in the supplemental, because 17%, I think, or 18% of the Alt-A business are investors, and investors, by definition, are rentals. I mean, that's what they mean. And so when you do the math and you convert everything to units, the only way you can meet these numbers is to use a large percentage of the Alt-A's to get there.
And do you have any, or have you seen any documents or any other evidence or any other statement by Fannie and Freddie that say that?
Or you're
talking more so in terms of the numbers?
No, I have two. I have anecdotal statements by them, quotes from various documents that talk about the importance of Alt-A. And then two, I've got this quantitative analysis that works into it from the numbers and says, hey, there's... So I hope this is helpful.
It has been incredibly helpful.
Don't stop on my account if you all want to keep going. I'm giving you back my
account. Okay, I've got yours.
I've already handed it over.
Okay. My plan at this point is I have been circulating this among academics and people in the industry and others getting their comments. I go through each of the sets of comments and then tighten it up and add stuff to it. It's literally up to 130 pages. This is just excerpts.
I like it.
130 pages, my goodness.
Yeah, plus the 80 pages of the exhibits that aren't part of this. Jeez. You know, the three exhibits that add up to about 80 pages. And so I expect when I get done, it'll probably be about 160 pages of chronology. The only way I could really get at this was doing a chronology, because by doing that, it connects all the dots. And so every day I'm finding more dots to connect. And Tom Lamalfa has been a big help.
Ed, I apologize.
Okay, Brad.
Always a pleasure. Very good to see you.
Same
very
here.
Good to see you.
All right, Bill.
I can stay a little bit longer if you need to. It's up to you.
My last question was going to be, have you prepared a chronology?
Yes.
Well, that's what this is.
This is what this is.
This is what this is. I have it year by year.
When can I expect a copy?
It's probably going to be a couple weeks.
All right. I'll give you a couple weeks.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what. This is a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you.
It's incredible.
It is chronological. Yeah.
It's
incredible.
Jump back and forth. Yeah.
Thank you.
My hat's off to you.
I tell you, when I put together the triggers memo, what I did then was I went through the triggers memo, and I went year by. I just searched by year, and then I extracted everything from the triggers memo and put it into year by year and organized it, and then I just started connecting dots and filling in the dots. And then the CRA thing, the way the CRA connection came up was my wife was reviewing it, and she goes through and makes edits and things. And there was a bank, Union Bank in Pittsburgh, that was an early CRA bank. And she said, well, whatever happened to them? Did they fail or did they do well? Did they prosper? I said, I never really looked. And so I Googled them, and I find, they were bought by, or they merged and became Integra. And then Integra ends up as Nat City. I go, Nat City? They were one of the biggest subprime lenders.
Yeah.
I said, this is too much of a coincidence. And so I go start looking at Nat City, and I start, and then I go, I wonder about the rest of these subprime, the banks that get into subprime. Because, again, not very many banks got into subprime. It's a handful. It's these seven. And that's it. And the rest of them stayed away. They just didn't want to do it. And then I started looking at these percentages on the CRA, and then I said, well, this is very odd. The CRA business, all the banks that get into subprime
are huge CRA participants, and they have been for a very long time, and no bank that gets into subprime didn't do CRA for a long time. And 93% of...
Oh, okay.
So it's almost like the rite of passage. You had to do CRA to get into, for whatever the connection is. I'm not sure exactly what the connection is, but the only banks that get into CRA, get into subprime in a big way, came through the CRA.
Because you wouldn't just jump into this little market. You wouldn't just...
You'd have to have
a place to sell it. Yeah. You wanted a place to sell it.
And you have to have a feel that it would be okay.
Yeah, and so I see what you're saying when it's the training wheels.
It's the training wheels. It's because these, and I'm going to put together a chart, and some of it, 1988, they do their first CRA commitment. In 1988. And in 1998, they go buy a subprime loan. And that repeats time and time again.
It also takes a while to become conversant.
Is most of that now these seven banks?
The subprime business that gets done by the bank holding companies are these seven banks.
Okay. So this expanded with other people and...
Well, it gets more concentrated. It was expanding in the early 90s. But by 1998, it's about 70% or 60% of the business is the top 25, and it stays at a very high percentage, which the mortgage industry generally is consolidating. But again, these seven banks grow to about 35% of the entire subprime, self-denominated subprime, and then if you throw in Wall Street, which I have to do, you probably get up to about 50%. And then the rest is done by, AmeriQuest is certainly the big, independent one. There are a couple other independent ones. And then you have the places like that don't fit a box, like AIG owns one, and General Electric owns one, and a couple others. But the big players are, besides the AmeriQuest.
They got their training in CRA.
They got their training. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, it appears that's the case. I know it's going to sound crazy here. It does sound crazy. But I don't know any other way of interpreting this. And it actually comes together with this merger issue.
Yeah.
The only hook that the regulators have on a lender
was
to hold up a merger. And so if you wanted to merge, you had to do CRA. And so I had already come up with the hypothesis that if you're going to pick a merger candidate, you'd pick someone who also was good in CRA, had announced a lot of CRA. Why? Because you don't want to have to retrain them. If you want to do another merger next year, remember, these were serial mergers.
Mr. Pinto, to take the adverse side on that, 98% of the banks that get rated on CRA get satisfactory or better.
You had to be more than satisfactory. You had to be outstanding.
Well, no, satisfactory or outstanding.
Right, but you really needed to, in order to get these mergers approved, you had to be up in the outstanding category. And these banks were in outstanding.
Do you think so? Because I could only find one bank that got their merger shot down on CRA basis. That was that first Chicago Trust.
No, the banks.
I thought Fleet or somebody got
the banks.
Fleet got bought up.
No, the banks ended up being preemptive on the way you avoided a merger challenge was by pre-announcing the CRA.
Right.
Or doing it in tandem.
They're doing it in tandem, but you pre-announced with the merger. You announced with the merger.
Right.
And so if you went in with two things, I've got an outstanding, my last rating was outstanding, and I just announced a $200 billion CRA commitment, you went through like a hot knife through butter.
Well, the Federal Reserve, which oversees most of this, says that they don't take into account at all those pre-announcements.
That's not true.
They're not allowed to.
That's not true. The testimony, and it's Bank of America, I have it in one of my, it's not in here.
Nations Bank? Bank of America, Nations Bank?
No, I think it was a later one. I'm not sure.
Go ahead.
There's a San Francisco hearing.
Yeah. Bank of America, Nations Bank.
And
2-day hearing.
Yeah, and they talk about the fact, and the witnesses for, and this is what the witnesses for Bank of America say, that they've announced a, whatever the $100 billion, whatever the commitment was, and that got the community groups to come in and basically say nice things.
Yeah. I know. The community groups say some nice things, although some of them say $350 billion, which was the amount, wasn't enough.
Right.
Okay, but they went about half and half.
Right.
About half the community groups were in favor of the merger, and about half of them weren't. But the Federal Reserve does a study of that and says, about half of them were for, about half of them were against. But irrespective of that, we're not allowed to take into account anything going forward. We can only look back at their mm-hmm. past record.
Again, the amount of public opposition is certainly important.
Which and this seems to...
This reduces the public opposition.
Right.
Or encourages the
I'm
public
not
support.
Trying to...
They're not inconsistent is all
okay.
I'm saying. The Fed can say exactly what it said, but the reality was... There was a reason why these banks were announcing these huge. I mean, these things got huge, bigger and bigger. Think about the one that Bank of America did for Countrywide, $1.5 trillion. Well, now, you don't think that had something to do with?
Well, I asked the Bank of America CRA people about that, and basically what they would say is, if you want community activists to support your merger, okay? Their fear is that you had two institutions and that they both had CRA opportunities.
Right.
And if you had Countrywide and you had, Countrywide's not regulated, but
right.
you had Countrywide and you had Bank of America and they both had CRA opportunities, that 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. Well, they're worried that 1 + 1 is going to end up equaling 1.
Right.
That you're going to cancel out Countrywide's
right.
commitments or agreements.
Right.
And so basically why those numbers got so big is they look backward,
yeah.
look at all the commitments, project out going forward, and then announce that number to the public and to those activists
right.
to say, we're going to meet both entities' outstanding commitments.
But, I mean, again, I think this is true. Once they started, and they started announcing these in, what, 90... Four, was that when the national commitment started being announced? I think it's in that NCRC thing. It was either 92 or 94 when they started announcing them. Once they started doing that, there were very few mergers that weren't approved, if any. I don't know.
Very few. 89 was the first Chicago Trust that got shot down.
I mean, again, people learned what to do, and they basically learned to preemptively mollify any objections by pre-announcing a large national commitment unnegotiated.
They also got better.
Unnegotiated.
It most of them were not negotiated.
Right.
They were just unconditional.
These are unilateral.
Unilateral. That's the word
we
they
call
used. Yeah. Unilateral.
The bank just said, like,
they weren't going
prior
to the shakedown anymore.
Prior
to cutting that process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Prior to that, they would sign agreements with community advocates.
It was a shakedown, like you said.
Well, I don't know that it's a shakedown, but what
we're missing
like,
one.
Like what NCRC
walk out of here with this?
Uh-oh. 4, 5.
Is that right?
3.
What about this one?
6.
I don't know.
1. We're missing number 2. Who's got number 2?
I just gave you mine, so it must be Borgers.
It's Borgers who walked.
Oh, we better go track him down.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell
around.
All right, I'm going to go off record. The time is about 10 of 6
okay.
Eastern Standard. Thank you much.